Welcome to the new episode of Impact Equals, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray Watson. It is not an exaggeration to say that my guest today was one of the founders of what is now called the impact investment industry. In 2001, Jacqueline Novogratz founded Acumen, a business that describes itself as a global community that fights poverty and builds dignity by investing in companies and changemakers using patient pioneer investing and for-profit impact funds. Jacqueline's two decades of work with Acumen have impacted over 500 million people across Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and the United States. To date, Acumen has invested more than $154 million of patient capital into 167 companies and is also responsible for nearly $243 million in assets under management via its for-profit funds, which have impacted 32 million people and offset 18 million tons of carbon. And if that wasn't enough, Acumen also trains social entrepreneurs and innovators through the Acumen Academy, which has cultivated 1,300 leaders in 61 countries whose collective work has reached tens of millions. And through its online courses, Acumen Academy has influenced more than a million individuals from 193 countries, unleashing a new generation of entrepreneurial builders grounded in the skills and attributes of moral leadership. Jacqueline is the author of two award-winning books, the best-selling The Blue Sweater and Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, Practices to Build a Better World. Jacqueline, it's absolutely fantastic to have you with us today. Thank you so much for your time.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me. It's truly a privilege.
Well, when you confirmed that you would be taking part in Impact Equals, I naturally bought a copy of your book, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, really in order to find a quote or two, a snippet, that I could use as a way of introducing this interview. But by the time I finished the first chapter, I'd underlined so many passages that really resonated that exercising in narrowing something down was rendered fairly futile. But I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs that, to my mind, really capture the essence of the book. And this comes from the introductory chapter. Yet the same forces that have shaped the world, technology and shareholder capitalism, hold within them the potential to destroy us. We are dangerously unequal and divided. We collectively face the ultimatum of our climate emergency. And many of the institutions devoted ostensibly to improving the lives of the many, not the few, are broken, yet we have not envisaged their replacements. We need a new narrative. We are too entangled to abide worldviews based on separation, nor can we look to simple technology or market solutions. These stories have run their course. We will be so much richer, productive, and peaceful if we learn not only to coexist, but to flourish, celebrating our differences while holding to the understanding that we are part of each other, bound together by our shared humanity. That narrative will not come from above, but from all of us. What we need is a moral revolution, one that helps us reimagine and reform technology, business, and politics, thereby touching all aspects of our lives. I mean, it's a daunting yet enthralling prospect. It would be great to know how you sort of first came to think about the challenge that we face in those terms.
Thanks, Andrew. You know, it's dawned on me recently that I've been doing this work for about 40 years now. And so I've actually grown up against a global backdrop that has changed fairly radically in my lifetime. And in many ways, I grew up as a child in a world of separation, whether we were made separate by nation, rich, poor, religion, certainly communism or socialism and capitalism. And then when I really came into this world at a global level, moving to Rwanda in 1986, I would say that that was also the beginning of the increasing interconnection that moved into full-on interdependence. And so I got to see through my career both the power of markets and the great benefits of capitalism. And so did I see that unbridled capitalism alone would do a lot of good in the beginning and exclude the people who we actually need to think not as hungry mouths to feed, but as human beings with the same unlimited potential and capacity that all of us have. And now, through 22 years of running Acumen, with 500 million low-income people impacted, I have seen the power of markets if they are combined with the right kind of philanthropy and concessional capital to actually enable people to be part of this system. And so have I seen the disproportionate impact of climate on the poor. And so have I seen the ramifications of a growing inequality through more and more civil unrest and more and more refugees. And while I would love to have one magic bullet, what excites me is that we know how to solve these problems. We have the capacity to think differently about how we use capital. And what's needed most is that we cultivate what I would call our own moral imagination, so that we can actually start with problems that we want to solve and build the right solutions from there, rather than assuming that the tools we have are ends in and of themselves.
I mean, one of the central themes you address in your book is, I guess, the fear that leads to inaction, right? The challenges we face are so daunting and so huge. A great many of us who perhaps might like to be more active participants in creating solutions.
Andrew, I hear that with particularly, I was going to say the younger generation, but I'm actually hearing that all over right now. The world is burning. These problems are too big. What could I even do if I tried? And again, I suppose it's one of the benefits for having been doing this work for so long is that I've been able to accompany individual entrepreneurs that have gone from a crazy idea to fundamentally changing systems and in some cases impacting hundreds of millions of lives. And so whereas many people get older and become more cynical, in many ways, I feel like I'm at a new chapter of feeling a great sense of possibility. We invested in two co-founders, Ned Tozin and Sam Goldman, in 2007 when they had this solar torch and a dream to eradicate kerosene, which at that time was the choice of fuel of about 1.5 billion people on the planet who had no access to electricity. It was almost a quixotic dream that they had, given that they didn't know how to price it. They didn't have distribution systems. The people they were trying to serve made $1 or $2, maybe $3 in a day. They had very little trust, and they were going up against a deeply entrenched status quo. Those companies that were delivering kerosene, diesel, who had no interest in some newfangled technology, taking them out. It's been a long 16 years, and yet that single company, D-Lite, has grown to bring over 160 million people clean, affordable, light and electricity in ways that then spawned an off-grid solar revolution. I have 10 stories like that, Andrew. But it didn't happen with business as usual investment, nor did it happen with government alone, nor did it happen with philanthropy alone. It was a combination of the right kind of character, the right kind of capital, and frankly, the right community, the right partnerships, all focused on the real goal, which is let's electrify this whole world, including the people that have been fully left out of the economy.
So let's take us back to the start, because once upon a time, that was you, wasn't it? I mean, in 2000, 2001, there was no impact investment industry to speak of. There were no guide rails to kind of point you in the right direction. You had to do it and make it up as you went along, essentially. How did you overcome those challenges initially?
I think most entrepreneurs, whether in the private sector or the social entrepreneurship sector, which is also the private sector, I don't think you fully understand the challenges you are taking on when you first step into it. And the first big challenge for me was the full-on pushback from almost everyone with whom I spoke, particularly venture capitalists in Silicon Valley and guys on Wall Street, who found it very easy to say that I clearly didn't understand business, that capitalism was intended to make money only for the shareholders on one side. And then when you had excess profits, then you could use it to do charity. And I was both naive, fuzzy-headed, and overly idealistic. And I think for me, the biggest challenge at the beginning was overcoming that regular sense of feeling a little humiliated. My ego that wanted to say, well, I've actually built a lot already. And sometimes did say it, always failing, therefore, to get any money. And then I started to realize I didn't need everybody. I only needed 20 individuals who would each give me philanthropy to get started. And over time, we would show the world. The truth was, I didn't fully understand what that path would look like, to your point. I did know that what I had been seeing wasn't working, and that charities were not scaling, and too often they were creating dependency, as were top-down government programs. And on the other side, it was clear that the markets, as they were not bringing critical goods and services to the people who most needed them.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think that looking at the title of your book, if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know it was a book about finance, right? It looks like a book about, a philosophical book about how to live your life. And clearly, from the title of the book, there is a very strong moral element that runs through your call to action and your reframing of what capitalism should look like. Is that challenging for some people to kind of take on board that there has to be a moral element to the sort of the reimagining of capitalism?
I would say in this moment of such political division, it has challenges for people on both sides. The funniest review I got was from a young woman who read the book and said, I thought I was going to read about Angela Davis burning down the system. And in fact, I'm reading a book on markets. And on the other side, to your point, this idea, not only that there needs to be a moral component, but that that moral component should be based not on a set of rules from above, but rather from a deep scientific, biological, and growing spiritual understanding that the real moral that we need is the acknowledgement that all of life is interconnected, that the DNA that's in us is in animals and plants, really every cell. And we use a framework of a world that puts man at the center of everything at our peril. That's a big shift. But my work of thinking about capital as a means to solving problems, not simply as an end in and of itself to make profit, has taught me, one, that the entrepreneurs that do the most to build systems that include low-income people in ways that also protect, conserve, nourish the earth, start with a strong moral compass so that their decisions are guided by who they are and their integrity, as well as insisting on enabling people to be part of their companies. Two, the capital providers also are infused with a moral compass that recognizes that capital has a critical role to play.
Indeed. And at the same time, you say that, you know, happiness lies in essentially giving more than you receive, which I imagine for a lot of fund managers must be quite puzzling.
I do say that the key to happiness is to give more than we take. And indeed, at Acumen, we ask ourselves, are we investing more than we are extracting? And that's an important part of this. It also keeps us more honest that we are here not just to invest money in a company, hold the entrepreneur fully to account monitor that entrepreneur, but rather accompany that entrepreneur. See his or her problems as our shared problems. Find, you know, use our social capital, not just our financial capital, our networks, our ability to have big mouths, to put them on stages, find grants if necessary, all with a focus on making the kind of change that's needed. Andrew, I was interviewing one of our entrepreneurs, a guy named David Ellis, who had started a company with a co-founder named Ethio Chicken. When they were 24, David never held a live chicken in his life, but they nonetheless had the audacity to build a chicken company in Ethiopia. We were their first institutional investors, and I must say it took them a year or two to convince us. It was very early stage. And I interviewed Dave after he'd grown the company to work with thousands of agents who were working with nearly a million farmers and really impacting Ethiopia in a way that was so convincing that government gave them credit for reducing child malnutrition by 11%. And in the chat were a number of people that would say, well, what she's really doing is talking to an entrepreneur who is the new colonialist. White guy comes to Ethiopia, builds a company. And I just had to stop the interview and say, wait, let's think about this. Here's a man that is making a long-term commitment to a company, creating at that point 1,000 jobs, unleashing human flourishing across. It's actually the opposite of extraction. Will he make money from this? Sure. And frankly, over the long term, he should. And I promise you, it will be over the long term. That company today is operating in 5 African countries. We're helping them go there through one of our for-profit funds, Acumen's Resilient Agriculture Fund. They work with 16,000 agents who work with tens of millions of smallholder farmers who buy or sell 50 million day-old chicks who are producing in this year 5 billion eggs. When you think about the broken industries that were present when they started and what they're actually contributing, then you have a definition of what it looks like to give more than you take.
Is it simplistic to sort of ask the question whether you need to monetize that philosophy in a sort of a crystallized, easy to understand form, i.e., you know, I guess to codify the value of giving more than you receive? I mean, is that what the industry needs to kind of development, or is it a more complex question than that?
I don't fully know the answer to that. In a way, can every individual and every institution hold itself to account for giving more than it takes? And in a world of growing transparency through the internet, will we start holding each other to greater account, whether we are individuals or whether we are institutions, is something I think a lot about. I am thinking very specifically these days about how do we measure, quantify, perhaps monetize the non-pecuniary impact of this work, these companies, so that we can bring in the right kind of capital in ways that really allow the companies to scale. And literally yesterday, I was speaking to a Harvard economist, asking him for the best economists, and I'd love to find an African economist who could work with us. We have all the data to look at all of the human change, as well as the environmental impact of bringing off-grid solar at scale into a nation, and look at counterfactuals so that we as a world might have a more nuanced conversation of what it is that we're trying to build, what kind of capital is needed unapologetically, as well as the kind of impact that can be expected and for which organizations should be held to account. And I think that's where we've really got to go. The capital that we have available to us who are trying to solve problems of poverty reinforces my understanding that the capital that is most expensive, or that capital is most expensive to those who can least afford it. It's not right.
And do you have a sense of how we should be changing that?
We are trying to change it. It's frankly been exciting to have conversations with BII because I think as a world, we're getting smarter and are recognizing that some of our old ways aren't working. And so I would say it's probably the way that I and Acumen do everything. As we learn, we change, we get stronger and more confident in pushing for the next step. So step one was the Acumen's Resilient Agriculture Fund, which I just mentioned with the chicken company. When we decided to build our first for-profit impact fund in smallholder agriculture in a time of often decimating a climate change, we thought a lot about the kind of capital that was needed. And frankly, we looked across the continent of Africa at the agriculture funds that were already in existence. And most of them had losses of 25%, some as much as 75% at a fund level. And so there was no way we were going into the market offering 20% returns, which is what we were still seeing impact funds doing. And luckily, we have the Green Climate Fund, as we'd already done one fund with them and we learned what a partner they were. And I initially pitched a negative 20% fund, which is probably going to make me lose all credibility in the world, just based on data, showed the data and said, let's be realistic about what's actually out there. And to their credit, they didn't send me packing, but instead said, can Acumen come forward with something? You know, I was obviously joking. And we together co-created the idea of a 50% first loss fund, where they would come in with the concessionary capital to protect downside risk so that more risk-averse capital, although this is very risky territory, would come in above it. And the understanding that side by side, you needed $7 million in grant facility to measure impact, yes, but also to help these companies build their own credit management systems and understanding of their employees and apps so that farmers could be more informed as participants in the company. Andrew, it has been thrilling to see some of the companies of ARF just taking off in an incredibly difficult environment because they have the right kind of capital, long-term capital that can take risk. That then helped us really look at the next facility initiative that we're building. That really helped us look at the next initiative that we're building, where we are trying to build on the work that we have done for the last 16, 17 years in off-grid energy, where our companies have reached 230 million people with access to off-grid solar and electricity. We asked ourselves, well, what would it take to reach SDG 7, universal electrification? And that leads you to the understanding that the large majority of the people who are fully left out of electrification live in 22 southern, sub-Saharan African countries. We would take on 16 and build an initiative that would enable us to work with companies and give them the incentives to go into more fragile countries. And I'm talking countries like Chad and South Sudan and Somalia and even Malawi, which has a 14% electrification rate. Sierra Leone and Benin. Go into those countries, set up markets where they have not really functioned, and also to stay. And so this is an initiative that has a significant $50 million grant component to help create markets, because we've now learned how to do it. And then a debt facility side by side, which will have significant first loss capital again. These blended capital structures that are, again, held to account, that measure what matters, not just the financial returns, I think not only are what we need, but we're at the beginning of a new chapter, which I hope is also a more honest chapter.
Yeah. And I think you're starting to see sort of the evolution of finance products that are impact indexed, if you like. So the cost of capital falls if the investee achieves a greater scale of impact, which has to be a good thing.
It's a really good thing. We did one small experiment in Benin, and the way we're also indexing the debt component. And it was thrilling to see how quickly and how effectively this local distributor was able to start to build out a customer base and be rewarded for it.
Can we just talk a bit more generally just about impact and the state of the industry today? Because obviously the industry is growing very fast. I think that the GIN believe the impact investment industry globally is worth $1.1 trillion this year. What does that evolution look like from your perspective? Because there's an awful lot of new players coming into the market. The phrase impact investing is being thrown around. I don't mean that in any derogatory sense, but it's being used increasingly by the mainstream sort of financial institutions in the world. Is that a good thing? I mean, what's your kind of perspective having seen it grow up over the last 20 years?
Remember, I started one of the first microfinance banks in Africa. And so I had the great privilege of seeing another movement right at the beginning go through chaotic times and then essentially become much more mainstream and institutionalized, even to a point where you had consumer protection integrated into the way that industry operates. I see a similar cycle with impact investing. Yes, it can be confusing that we are at a moment where it seems like everybody is creating impact investing funds, and some of them are rightly being accused of greenwashing, and we have to pay a lot of attention to that. At the same time, my experience has reinforced for me that language almost always precedes change behavior. And so it's a very good thing. And that we're seeing a marked generational shift where the younger generation is demanding that family offices and overall investment strategies integrate impact into the way that people invest. So I have watched it go from the very beginning where, as I said, people laughed at us. That gave me the confidence now to tell young entrepreneurs that it's when they call you crazy that you know you're on to something, so keep moving. To 2012, 2013, when more institutional players came into the market and said, well, we can do impact investing better than the players that are out there and make significant returns. And there's truth there too. If you are investing in companies like Tesla or other companies that are creating at scale important environmental solutions, et cetera, not as true if you're trying to go where markets and government have failed the poor at a generational level. And so I find myself, Andrew, always needing to make a plea for nuance, that the very idea of impact investing is so important that my hope is at one point we do not need a modifier.
The appeal for nuance is often falls on, it's an increasingly challenging one these days, isn't it? No one likes nuance particularly.
No one likes nuance, and yet this goes back to the ideas of moral revolution, that it's not about white, black, right, wrong. The real revolution that has to come from inside of us, not above nor below us, is a revolution in our own consciousness, a maturation, if you will, because no longer can we navigate the world in binaries, rich, poor, white, black, as I said, the capitalism, socialism. We've got to learn to hold values in tension. We've got to learn to create profitable companies in ways that also recognize many stakeholders, all of the stakeholders, our customers, our employees, the natural resources that we utilize. And we have to be held to account if we're exploiting people or planet. That's easier in some places to do than other places. And so as individuals, as companies, as governments, we need a new set of skills and tools. And that actually starts with being more willing to acknowledge nuance and hold nuance. And to your point, what makes that so difficult is that you're trying to explain it in a world that is getting shriller, seemingly, by the day. I do find, though, a yearning for deeper understanding, a yearning for more kindness, a yearning for solutions that make us believe again.
Yeah. And that's a wonderfully optimistic note. I think that's a really encouraging note. I'm asking all our guests on this series the same question. When you look at the impact investment industry, what are the kind of the major trends that you're seeing developing over the next few years?
One is scale. I just talked about it, that I don't think you can run any major financial institution without integrating impact into the way you measure and the way that you report to your investors. And so impact investing is here to stay. Two is actually greater nuance and greater comfort with concessionary financing. There is a growing understanding, and frankly, equally, there is a growing level of anger that our development finance institutions aren't taking enough risk. They are often not investing for the long term, because we are seeing the power of entrepreneurs in solving our big problems. On the other hand, all of us increasingly recognize that the private sector alone will not solve those problems, and that the development finance institutions can also play a powerful role in partnering and influencing policy and creating better government partnerships. That would lead me to the third trend that I'm seeing, which is a growing understanding, which will require another new skill set, which is that solving our big problems will take all of us. And so we all have to develop sharper, more expansive tools for partnering and collaborating across sectors, across lines of difference. You so kindly mentioned that, I don't know if it was kind or it was good advice when you said, funny to have a book called Manifesto for a Moral Revolution that's all about finance and the markets. And it is really great feedback. But I think this book is really about 12 principles for how to build businesses and organizations that are constructed to put our shared humanity and the earth at the center of our systems, and not simply profit and not simply the individual. And despite a lot of the bad news out there, I do see an equal and growing trend amongst a new generation rising that wants to be on that train. That gives me great, great hope. But we have some big tailwinds to fight right now. No, we have some big headwinds to fight right now, including in our largest financial institution that need to be radically restructured, really changed, starting with the World Bank all the way through, that too often are focused on their returns rather than renewing the missions with which they were established and being held to account for the change that they are making. I think particularly given who your listeners are, one of the things I should have said about some of the trends, that I think that's the bigger place, is that when I think about some of the current trends, particularly in frontier markets or emerging markets, we are seeing how the big macroeconomic factors like currency devaluation, inflation, have been huge challenges that further exacerbate customer affordability. And affordability in these markets is everything. So that's one. Because of those macro factors, we're watching a lot of really good companies not only go through an extremely difficult moment, but they start chasing bad capital. So then they become even more indebted and they have even more limited liquidity. In the developed worlds, 81% of green investment is funded by the private sector. In frontier markets, VC accounts for about 14%. And so there's a real imbalance if we're seriously focused on structuring our financial systems, our markets, our development finance institutions in ways that actually help solve our big problems. What my plea to the DFIs would be is, number one, don't wait for others to provide guarantees like the one I described before, or first loss before they move. Two, make long-term commitments. And three, just take more risk that they stop leaving money and therefore impact on the table. I really believe we can solve these problems. I've seen it. And that actually brings with it a moral imperative. Solving our problems of electricity and agriculture and healthcare and education has productive implication, has security implications. And at the end of the day, it's a moral imperative.
I could happily talk on the subject for hours, but unfortunately time does not allow. But all I'd say to our listeners is, if you are within the impact investment industry or thinking about getting into it or just looking to take that leap and become an entrepreneur in your own right, then read Manifesto for Moral Revolution. It is an inspiring read and there's some great lessons and some great takeaways in there. Jacqueline, thank you so much for your time. It has been absolutely inspiring talking to you. And to our listeners, thank you very much for listening in. Until next time.